Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Total Film's Last Picture Show. The elevator pitch? It's the end of the world, and you have one last night at the cinema. What four films are you programming, and why? Our guest today is a film journalist well-known to Total Film readers and podcast listeners. He started out as news editor before moving to features editor, and is currently deputy editor, wrangling everything from high-profile interviews and reviews to set visits, film festivals, and junkets. It's Total Film's resident Nolan expert and the man The Rock tweets at calling bro, Matt Matum.
If you smell what The Rock is cooking.
Welcome, Matt, to The Last Picture Show. Are you feeling nervous about being on this, having done this for other people a lot?
I am, yes, and I'm not used to being on this side of the interview, so very unusual experience for me.
I know, and now you can't complain like when people give you rubbish answers, because if you do, then, you know, it's all on you. Shall we kick off then with telling us all about the first film that you ever saw at the cinema?
The first memory I have of actually going to the cinema is going to see Snow White and the Seven Dwarves, a reissue, I should say, and not getting in because the queues literally were busting blocks and going round the corner and all the way down the street. And I sort of missed that almost. I missed that feeling of like where you could physically see the excitement of a screening because there were just so many people there. And then the manager obviously came out and told us, like, there's no way you're getting into this. You might as well go home. And had a similar experience with Beauty and the Beast a few years later. Obviously, having allocated seating and pre-booking your tickets is, you know, nice and convenient. But I do miss the excitement of, am I actually going to get into this popular showing?
Yeah, so, and it's the halo effect, isn't it? You feel clever for having chosen that film. Yes. Look at me. I was one of the first people in the queue and I got in. I remember that with Moonwalk with Michael Jackson in Leeds. So where was this cinema experience that you actually did have in the end when you actually got into the first film?
I mean, I'm pretty sure it was the Canon Cinema, as it was then, in Chatham, in Medway, in Kent, where I've sort of spent most of my life. And it was the old sort of flea pit cinema that's not there anymore, but that was the one I went to lots in my childhood before they had sort of lots of big multiplexes kind of springing up everywhere. So saw lots of things there. It was very cheap. I still can just vividly picture just what the sort of foyer looked like, what the seating arrangement was, where the best seat was, which was kind of just above the sort of stairwell you walked up, kind of the seats just on top of that were perfect because like no one could get in your way and you were sort of just close enough, not too far back. So it was fond memories of that place.
And do you remember sort of thinking about the experience as a completely different thing from having seen stuff on TV? Did it blow your mind to see something on a screen that big, sit in the dark with other kids, have a sound system that's surrounding you? Well, it wouldn't have been that brilliant in that day, but still better than your telly at home in your lounge.
There was something very, very transporting about it, just the sort of overwhelming size of the screen. And that's why I love IMAX these days. And sort of if I can ever see a blockbuster in IMAX, I do, just because I love the feeling where the screen's just that tiny bit too big and it just sort of just dwarfs you and you just feel like you're really sort of sucked into it. That's what I'm always going for with the cinema. None of this like feeling like a big TV kind of thing when you're in one of the smaller screens. It's got to be as big as possible for me.
Yeah, and you've also got to negate the falling asleep aspect that you have at home.
Yes.
You want something as big and as loud as possible to really, like, keep you alert. Otherwise, you can just drift off on the sofa, can't you?
I'm pretty sure I did drift off during a couple of those very young cinema experiences, but I can't remember what the films were. I think maybe, I mean, like I say, Snow White's the first one I remember, and that's obviously quite a classy one to say, but I think there was some sort of feature-length He-Man animation I went to see that I fell asleep during when I was like 3 or something, but I just have no memory of it, so I'll take Snow White. That's a sort of a nicer one to have as your first film.
And when did you sort of realise you could, you know, watch films for a job?
Very, very, very late on, to be honest. Like, I probably was about, like, I don't know, at least 18 or something, and as someone who just grown up like absolutely loving reading sort of film magazines and everything and sort of obsessing over that side of things, then it just something suddenly clicked in my mind that I was like, oh wow, someone must actually work there and actually write these reviews and do these interviews and things, and that must literally be the best job ever. And then I kind of almost sort of resigned it to like, oh, that I'll just never be able to get into that. It's just a sort of pipe dream. Some years later, I thought, like, I was in a very boring job I just didn't like and had absolutely no sort of passion for or anything. And I just thought, oh, I might as well give it a go. And then I ended up, after lots of trying, getting some work experience at Total Film, and then never looked back after that, really.
Just we kept you.
Clung on, kept doing bits and pieces, was kind of coming in the office more and more. And then before I knew it, I was just kind of pretty much there all the time. And I had a full-time job. And then I've just stayed since then. That was like more than 10 years ago now, which is just terrifying to me. But they still haven't managed to get rid of me yet, so... And still clinging on there.
The question that everyone will always ask you, and never they meet you and find out what you do, who is the best person you've ever interviewed?
I mean, personal favourites. I'll go into sort of obviously a bit more on this person later, but Christopher Nolan's got to be very, very high up there, having interviewed him a couple of times. That's always just very, very, very high up my list. Very excited to do those. When you do it a lot, like us, I don't know if you do, but I don't really get that nervous before most interviews now, but there's a handful that you kind of feel like you're sort of shaking beforehand. That's definitely one of those times. And then I've been lucky to interview Tom Cruise a couple of times, which has been always very exciting. Again, well, we need to get a wall chart really, but we have a sort of a wall chart in our minds at Total Film of the people who call direct for interviews. And it's a very, very small, rarefied group that actually are not just being sort of patched through by sort of various PR people. And Tom Cruise is one of those. And when your phone rings and you kind of know that's the that's TC. What the call is going to be, there's electricity in the air when that happens. And when you just hear sort of such a recognisable voice on the other side of the phone, you know, that's never not exciting.
Okay, so we'll talk more about your experiences on Total Film as we go along, but we should probably look at your first film on this last day of watching films in the big cinema on a big screen. What is the first film that you're going to program?
The first one is 2001: A Space Odyssey.
I've wondered whether you might be having some second thoughts about the mission.
How do you mean?
Rumors about something being dug up on the moon. I never gave these stories much credence, but particularly in view of some of the other things that have happened, I find them difficult to put out of my mind.
Open the pod bay doors, please, Hal.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
That is an absolutely stonker soundtrack, but obviously an absolute classic of a film. I know, because I work with you, that you're a massively Kubrick fan.
Yes.
Hugely. Was this the film that started that all off? Why this film in your projector booth?
The reason I chose this one, and this is the first one, I kind of specifically put these films in order as well, thinking about what I actually would show people if this was the last day in the cinema. And I sort of thought what I'd show them, what order I'd put it in. And they just had to be films I obviously loved as well. I didn't want any kind of like sort of pretentious choices or sort of, you know, the like if I was doing my sort of sight and sound top 10 list, you know, that you might go for to look more clever. I just wanted to do sort of pure favourites. And this is one that I don't really like making lists of like favourite films. I always kind of struggle if, you know, like when you've got, you know, choosing any, even of a year, I struggle to kind of put films in order, let alone of all time. But if I kind of was backed into a corner and sort of had to narrow it down, this is what I would call my favourite film of all time. And I love Stanley Kubrick's films, and The Shining's also been a kind of a contender for my top spot over the years as well. Because basically, I just love them because on the one hand, there's so much to sort of unpack, like thematically, visually, etc. Then also, they just work as like really gripping, exciting films on their own terms. So I love that, like, you know, there's so much you can get out of them if you want to, and so much you can kind of want to read about afterwards and talk about. But at the same time, you can just enjoy it on that sort of pure sensory level as well. That's why I love his film so much. And so I had to have a Kubrick film in here. And yeah, this being my top one. It was one of those films, I was aware of it for quite a long time before I saw it. Like, I obviously saw the Deep Space Homer episode of The Simpsons before I saw it. So I was aware of all these kind of key cultural touch points in it, such as, you know, the match cut of the bone and the soundtrack, you know, the score that we talked about, the music that it uses. And, you know, all these different elements. Hal, obviously everyone's aware of Hal. So I came to it with sort of quite a lot of expectations. And then I was probably about 15 or so when I actually properly watched it, and a friend kind of talked me into watching it. I was sort of had nerves about it being a bit pretentious or a bit boring or perhaps hard to get my head around. But then I was just sort of just totally sort of sucked into it and just loved all the different sections. I loved that it just felt so epic. I loved that it just spans such a ridiculous amount of time. I mean, I don't know if it still is classified as, maybe I'll check in a minute, but it was classified as a U for a long time, but there's some genuinely quite unsettling stuff in it, even though there's nothing that, you know, technically you think there's no gore or anything like that, but there's some really sort of unsettling scenes in there. Yeah, I just love you get all these different aspects to it, and again, it's just so kind of so open to interpretation, and yeah, then it's just a film I've then revisited a lot over the years.
How many times do you think you've seen it?
I mean, probably about 10, maybe. So, I mean,
that is nothing compared to Jamie Graham's compared to some rewatching.
I certainly haven't rewatched any films like I rewatched in my teens. Like, there was a handful of films. I'm trying to think of what some of them would be. Like, From Dusk Till Dawn is one that sort of sticks to my mind, because in the summer holidays, me and my brothers, we'd pretty much always just, there would just be one film we would have just got new on VHS, and we would literally just watch it every day. Romeo and Juliet, the Baz Luhrmann film, that was another one that I watched just day after day after day in my teens. But I don't have time for that these days, so sadly. So no film's ever going to get close to those, really, those numbers. But yeah, so probably about 10 times, and I've seen it sort of, you know, in lots of different settings. Like, I've obviously seen it at home. I saw it at a festival once, sort of a midnight screening at a festival. I saw the unrestored cut that Christopher Nolan sort of toured when that was at the IMAX at the Science Museum. So that was really great, with the intermission in, you know, and everything. So I like when you get the intermission. And also, most recently, I saw it at the South Bank Centre, accompanied by an orchestra and choir. And that was just absolutely amazing. That was definitely high up there on the best sort of cinema experiences.
You're going to put that in this one? Maybe get the entire orchestra and the choir in for your screening?
Yes, I think so, yeah. Especially, like, if you've seen it before. I wouldn't have wanted that to be my first showing, but if you've seen it before, as most people have, there was just something amazing about how you could kind of, you could still get sucked into the film, but then every now and then you could just look and just see the musicians just going for it. And again, I absolutely love that kind of creepy choral singing that you get at key points in the film around the monolith. So just hearing that sort of live, it was really like goosebumps inducing. And I don't know how frequently they do it, but it's one of those things I definitely would try and see that again if I could. I would go yearly if they did it every year.
Okay. So we need to put a call into them that they need to be coming. Yes. So as we start off this programme, which cinema are you going to be doing this in? What's your beloved place to see a film in the dark?
This is a tough one, but if I had to go for one, I would say the BFI, IMAX and Waterloo, simply because what I was saying earlier, really, to repeat the comment, but the biggest screen possible. That is, as far as I'm aware, the biggest screen in the UK. And just something about it and the sort of stadium seating aspect of it I love, and the fact the screen feels so huge. The building's just very cool, the way it's in the
it's
middle of the big...
It's very apt for this film, isn't it? All the circular sort of design and entrances. It feels very Kubrick.
Yeah, and it just feels very exciting, just the way you enter the screen and the way you go up the stairs, and then how sort of kind of steep the seats are, and the fact that you can... Even the fact you can only exit through the back and you've got to go down all those stairs, it just feels like an exciting building to go to. So that would be my top choice. But I love going to any cinema. I love trying out new cinemas, just that sort of popcorn smell in the foyer. And just, there's just something exciting about going to different ones. And obviously, if you ever go to cinemas in other countries as well, I just love that. I don't know, it just brings back a tingle of that sort of childhood excitement, because I guess because it feels fresh again, because it's an unfamiliar place. But yeah, any chance I get to go to a cinema, like if I'm on holiday or something, I just always will.
Yeah. Okay, so let's move on to your second film and what you'll be getting the audience ready for after 2001, what film is incoming next?
Okay, so I had to choose a Christopher Nolan film, and I've chosen The Dark Knight.
Cops and lawyers wouldn't dare cross any of you. I mean, what happened?
So what are you proposing?
It's simple. Kill the Batman. Here's my card.
So Christopher Nolan's The Dark Knight. As colleagues, we know you're a massive Nolan fan. Why this particular one? And why this particular one out of all of his Batmans? Mm.
Good question. Yes, well, I could have chosen almost any Nolan really from this list. I would sort of love them all really. But if I had to, again, backed into a corner, had to choose my favourite, it would be this, partly because I'm a Batman obsessive as well. Like, Batman's my favourite sort of pop culture character. Batman's my Star Wars, as they say, sort of growing up. Even from, like, probably my first interaction would have been the Adam West series. And there's just something about the character, again, just the iconic look and everything. But just always loved Batman. Obviously, also obsessed with the Michael Keaton films growing up. Batman Forever is probably scarily on my most watched list as well, because I had that on VHS and was like ill from school, kind of, you know, the week it came out on VHS, and so just watched it repeatedly. So I just always loved Batman. So yeah, so Batman was good to get on the program for me. I also think as well, it's sort of the middle one, obviously, of the Dark Knight trilogy. But I do think it works really well as a sort of standalone film. Like, I love the others as well, but, you know, you can watch it without having seen Batman Begins. Everyone knows Batman and understands that and can just be sort of thrown in from the beginning with it. And it does have a fairly sort of definitive ending for a sort of midpoint in a sort of trilogy as well. So I think everyone's kind of satisfied. It's obviously a huge crowd pleaser. And I was talking to someone about this the other day, but I'm sure it must be the film I've most looked forward to ever. And I'm sad to say this, but I don't think it'll ever really be topped really by looking forward to another film. Obviously, I'm excited about many, many films every year, and certain ones you get particularly giddy about, and I'll always get particularly giddy about a new Nolan, obviously. But this one, I was just obsessed with it, basically, because I loved Batman Begins. I loved what he'd done with that. I'd loved his films, particularly Memento before Batman Begins. I loved Christian Bale. And then I was like a huge Heath Ledger fan as well. So when he then got cast, I was just like, oh my God, they're literally just making this film for me. Weirdly as well, because this was way before I worked in this biz, I actually bumped into Heath Ledger when he was filming this. Not he wasn't filming at the moment, but he was in London to film it, and just had a very brief interaction with him in the street. So it kind of had fond memories of it on that level as well. And I just love it. Like, his performance as the Joker, obviously not just one of the best sort of villain performances, but one of my favourite performances of all time, easily. I just love how he just completely disappears under the makeup, and how he just feels so different from the guy you might have seen in Brokeback Mountain or 10 Things I Hate About You. And I just love his kind of chaotic presence in the film, and how he's sort of scary, but really funny as well, and sort of reinvents this character that we were all sort of so familiar with, and obviously that Jack Nicholson did so sort of memorably as well. So he had that to sort of contend with, but just completely made it his own. So I just absolutely love this film. So that's why.
So what happened in the street with Heath?
Just literally just said, hello, I'm a fan of your work, etc. And he was like, oh, thanks. And that was basically it. And I think I asked him if he was over to film it, because it was either that day or the day before they just released the first kind of viral image of him, which was that sort of close up with the sort of the red lips, but just very sort of close up on his face. So I was like, oh, I love the look of the Joker. And he was like, oh, thanks, you know. It was very, very low key, and I didn't want to sort of bother him too much, but it was, yes, a moment I look back on very fondly.
Favourite scene?
If I had to choose, I mean, again, it's one of those films I just love from start to finish. And I love the prologue, obviously. And that was one where I went to see I Am Legend for a second time, despite the fact I really didn't like I Am Legend, just so that I could see the prologue play before it at the BFI IMAX of all places. And I love that scene, but if I had to choose, it would be this sort of centerpiece interrogation scene between Batman and the Joker at the police station. I just love it on so many levels. I just love the way he's, like the Joker is pushing the buttons of Batman. I love that it feels kind of, especially for what is, you know, broadly speaking, it's like, you know, you could consider it a family blockbuster because it's a 12A, it's a sort of a very popular character. But then it feels genuinely kind of dangerous in that scene, like, and I love the chemistry between the two of them. You genuinely feel that, like, Batman could lose it and, you know, when he kind of drags the chair to the door to kind of lock the door and keep the police out. That would be my favourite scene.
Mm. So speaking of Nolan, obviously that leads me to set visits because you obviously have been on a Nolan set. You were on Tenet. You saw an entire plane being crashed into a building because he doesn't do it with models. Obviously that was an amazing experience for you. But what other set visits have you been on that have sort of stayed in your mind that you'll be thinking of on this final day?
Another huge one was Avengers Infinity War, where I went out to Atlanta, to the Pinewood Studios in Atlanta for that. That was just amazing because it was so secretive. Like, everything about it was like, we had to have like stickers put over the cameras of our phones and things like that. You had to sign these crazy NDAs and all sorts of things like that. As with all set visits, there's a lot of waiting around, but then we got to see some, you know, some on-set action, and there were just so many Avengers there, basically. So there were just interviews with just so many of them coming out in kind of groups. So one, it was a day just to tick off a lot of, you know, like kind of bucket list interview folk, like, you know, Robert Downey Jr., Chris Hemsworth, Tom Holland, Mark Ruffalo, just loads of the Avengers lineup. And then there was just something, yeah, just amazing about seeing them all together, seeing them interacting, seeing them in costume as well. Chadwick Boseman was there in his Black Panther get up. So that was obviously very cool, and just the sheer scale of it and what kind of I saw that day being filmed must literally amount to like 2 seconds on screen, but it was obviously so huge, everything that was going on. So that was a hugely exciting one.
You talked about this kid that really liked to read about these set visits and stuff, and now you're actually doing it. Does that change the way you watch films now? Are you able to just enjoy a film when you're not being critical and reviewing it, or you're not doing it for work? How does your relationship with film change now you've got this job?
I find it surprising how much I can still just watch a film and enjoy it, because you would think in many ways it would just be completely ruined by seeing it. But Tenet, for example, I was just totally sort of sucked into it when I actually watched it. I don't know, I suppose there was a certain part of my brain that wasn't really, you know, like, because I was so excited by the sort of that whole plane sequence. Again, especially with the immersion of that being sort of shot on IMAX as well. I just wasn't really thinking about it too much. And even, I mean, we're kind of lucky in the sense that we don't really have many bad interview experiences. They're very few and far between. But I found on the rare occasion where you either have a bad interview experience with someone or you hear of someone else having a bad interview experience with that person, I then still can just watch the film and just enjoy it and just think they were great in that film or whatever it may be. Or if someone's messed you around with cover art or something like that, you know, and a certain part of my brain just switches off and just kind of enjoys the film. And I find, weirdly, that's one of the biggest challenges almost of the job, when I'm actually reviewing a film as opposed to just watching it for fun or watching it as kind of, you know, background for an interview or something. I find it hard sometimes almost to switch on the analytical part sometimes, because I need a certain degree of that immersion to kind of enjoy it and kind of enjoy it and experience it in the same way that a punter would. Yeah. And so as cheesy as this sounds, one of the things that does that for me is seeing films with my wife, because despite obviously kind of, you know, being married to me and living with me, she is quite innocent of like everything that goes on. And so she could just go and see anything completely sort of unpretentiously and be sort of largely unaware of what would have happened behind the scenes. And say, for example, in a Marvel film or something like that, where we may know that a certain character did a certain thing in the comics or that we're expecting a certain cameo or something, she would just go in completely innocent of that. So I find that I get that sort of vicarious enjoyment of someone just experiencing
discovering
it completely new. So that's the thing. I use that as a sort of, you know, like a measuring tool of how a film plays with, you know, just the average punter. And that's a thing that always, you know, touch wood always helps as well. So I always like it. We go to a lot of press screenings, obviously, but then it's nice to then just go and see the film in a regular cinema as well and just see how it works and how it plays like that.
Indeed. Okay, shall we go on with the programme then? Tell us what's next.
Next is another middle film of a trilogy, and it's Before Sunset.
Years ago, two strangers met by chance and spent a night in Vienna that ended before sunrise. They are about to meet for the first time since.
Hi.
Hello.
I can't believe you're here.
Well, I live here in Paris.
I wanted to talk to you for so long, you know, that now...
Me too. How long do we have? 20 minutes and 30 seconds? No,
we got more than that.
Now they have one afternoon to find out if they belong together.
I remember that night better than I do entire years.
Do you look any different? I do.
I'd have to see you naked.
What?
You obviously are a massive fan of Before Sunrise, which is Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy in Vienna. But then we get this follow-up, which revisits the characters in Paris. He's a successful author and is married, and she's living in the City of Love. So why the second film, not the first film? What is it about the second one that has the charm factor?
I mean, this is a tricky one as well, because this is a bit like the Dark Knight trilogy, where I'd happily watch any of them on my last day at the cinema, and I sort of would give 5 stars to each of them easily and sort of love them all in their own way. But if I had to choose, this would be my favourite. I love legacy sequels, for want of a better word, which obviously I wouldn't necessarily describe as this, but where you get a true feeling of the passing of time. And of course, it will surprise no one to know that I love Boyhood as well, the Richard Linklater film, that kind of plays with time in a slightly different way to these, but you get that same sort of feeling of like a life lived and time passing. I'm just a real sucker for that, when it sort of feels authentic, when the actors actually age on screen. There's something about the second one I just find so sort of bittersweet, because you know they didn't meet up like they intended to after Before Sunrise. Apologies for the spoilers if anyone hasn't seen Before Sunrise yet. But then you just get this just amazing, magical sort of like walking and talking day with the two of them. And I've only really watched it probably like a handful of times, because I almost find the feeling's too intense, if you know what I mean. Like, it kind of stabs me in the heart a bit. So I just can't sort of put myself through it too often, because there's this such sort of ticking clock element to it, where he has to get back for his flight because he's just over for a sort of, you know, a promotional sort of tour. And you know all this time they're kind of talking, the time is counting down basically, and he's got this flight to catch. And I genuinely like find myself getting like short of breath almost as it kind of gets nearer, and you're kind of like, oh, he's going to have to leave soon, or he's going to have to make some kind of call soon. They're easily my favourite on-screen couple, just like the chemistry and everything. Same with this one. Why I choose the middle one over the other two for this day is that, like, you get that sort of weight of the experience from the first film that you kind of bring to this second film. But then it's very much left with that sort of promise and the sort of ambiguous side of it, and not wrapped up in the way that when you actually see Before Midnight, you're like, oh, so that's sort of what happened next. I like the sort of open-ended nature of it. And I just absolutely loved the scene where she sings the song to him in the apartment before.
And he's watching her sitting on the sofa.
That's another one that sort of just like stabs me in the heart, really. And it's like 80 minutes as well. That's another reason why I've kind of structured this programme in this way, that I think you've obviously got the full-on, you know, kind of immersive and just full-fat cinema experience of 2001, and then the kind of intense blockbusteriness of The Dark Knight. And then this is a bit more gentle, and then it's obviously shorter, but it's still obviously kind of intense dramatically in a lot of ways, but it's a bit shorter, a bit lighter. easier on the heart to sort of wind you down after this long day in the cinema. So that was another reason why I placed this one here.
Are you also romantic? Is it that, you know, it is incredibly romantic, this idea of the one that got away, and could you get that lost love back? It's something that haunts a lot of people. Is this sort of story something that you like to watch in the cinema?
100%, yeah. Like I'm a real, real sucker for love stories that take place over time, you know, and especially those that don't quite work out, or, you know, don't seem like they're going to quite work out. I'm just a sucker for that in any form, really. So if it's a bit sort of wistful, that's right up my street, basically. And this being just the absolute zenith of that type of film. And perhaps the sort of film that got me onto that type of film, maybe, as well, because I sort of saw them in fairly close succession around the time the second one actually came out, because I hadn't seen the first one earlier. But I liked the idea of it, and so I thought I'd sort of give it a go. And I didn't realise how, when I was watching the first one, I didn't realise how much I'd been sucked into it until they sort of pass at the train station at the end. And I was like, oh God, you know, like what? I just, you know, when it kind of a film really creeps up on you. And then, yeah, then this one, I was just like, you know, completely blown away by this one. And I love Before Midnight as well. I sort of have that nervous feeling of like, of course, I desperately want them to do another. But at the same time, I'm just like, I don't know. Like, and I worry that if they do another, they just can't be together. So I almost hope they leave at at 3. Got the Criterion box set as well, so I don't really want to have to buy another one to sort of shove on the end.
But yeah, indeed. Yes. Are you a crier in the cinema?
Very much so now, yes. Like, I think I was as a kid. I kind of cried at anything as a kid. The first one that I remember being The Grasshopper and the Ants, which I don't know if you've ever seen it, but it's on Disney Plus if you want to sort of see it. It's like a super old Disney short. I mean, it is a bit touching, but I was in absolute floods of tears as a child. And then all through my kind of then slightly older childhood and teens and everything, I felt moved by films, but I just never like leaked any tears in the cinema. The film which got me going again, of all films, weirdly, was Finding Neverland. And that sort of opened the floodgates, and then just basically anything's up for grabs now. Like I sometimes almost shed a tear when just something's just so good. sounds ridiculous, but when I rewatched Top Gun Maverick recently, the sequence where Mav goes out on the run to kind of prove it can be done in like 2.5 minutes, I kind of basically had like a tear trickling down my cheek, because I was just like, this is just so damn good. Like, it's so well done, this scene, and so sort of triumphant. Yeah, so that happens to me sometimes. And I had it when I saw a re-release of Back to the Future in the cinema as well, quite a few years ago. I almost shed a tear at just how good it was as a film, you know, that I was just like, just grateful for how good it was. But yes, I will cry very easily at films these days.
It's interesting then. So do you think you use film as a sort of therapeutic tool?
Sometimes. I mean, I definitely understand when people say like, oh, you need a good cry or whatever. Sometimes I think, oh, I need to put on a film like that to kind of
have a blob,
get it out, basically. But I haven't done it for a while, so I'm sort of overdue sort of picking something out, maybe something like E.T., but I've sort of reached a stage now, because of having young children, obviously on one level that makes you, or me anyway, it makes me like a much worse crier at films. But then revisiting certain classics such as E.T., which I haven't watched for so long, I sort of think I want to wait till my kids are old enough to watch it, because I can't subject myself to that many re-watches of it. So I might as well save myself for when they're old enough to appreciate it. But I do need to watch something to sort of clear the tear duct again, I think, because it's been a little while now.
Okay, so that's your prescription for after this. Get yourself a weepy. Shall we go to your final film? This may be one that makes you cry. Which is it?
It was so hard to choose, obviously, because there's just literally so many that could have gone in, but it had to be Toy Story.
My name is Woody. This is my spot.
I am Buzz Lightyear. I come in peace.
You are a child's plaything.
You are a sad, strange little man.
And playing by their own rules.
Draw. Fuck me again.
I don't like confrontations.
Buzz, look, an alien.
Where?
You're mocking me, aren't you?
Oh, impressive. impressive wingspan. Very good.
Oh, what? What? You can't fly.
Yes, I can.
You can't.
Can.
Can't.
To infinity and beyond.
Toy Story.
Look out!
Can.
So Toy Story recently come full circle with Lightyear at the cinema. But why Toy Story? Why are you going to close out this program with that classic?
I was doing that thing where I was thinking very much about what it would actually be like to watch these films in the cinema. I thought this would be a nice end point for people, a nice sort of palate cleanser, where I find it a very touching film, but it is light and easy to watch. And again, very short, about 80 minutes again. Just delightful and sort of funny and enjoyable. So I sort of think, oh, this is one film that literally everyone can enjoy. It's also a film that was kind of a pivotal film viewing experience for me because it came out in 1995, so I was like 11 when it came out. And I remember reading loads about it before it came out, and so I was kind of just getting to the age where I was sort of understanding more about films being made, and I suppose coming down this path that I've obviously ended up coming down to in an extreme way. I was just at the age where I was old enough to understand that it was a big deal and that it was, you know, an important sort of game changer in a way, sort of for cinema and filmmaking, that it was just entirely CG animated, but young enough to still just completely just enjoy the film and just get completely swept up in it in an uncynical way, and young enough to sort of lust after the toys and the Buzz Lightyear still as well. For that reason, it sort of holds a special place in my sort of heart and memories of cinema going experience. And on a similar level, Jurassic Park was another real contender to get in here for me, because that probably ranks as my all-time favourite cinema experience, because, again, it was that thing of being at that sweet spot in terms of age where I was old enough to realise it was a huge deal and old enough to sort of sense there was this real excitement around this film coming out, but also young enough to just be absolutely terrified by it. And I still absolutely love it to this day, but I sort of thought, it's a bit intense. It's a bit too much of an intense roller coaster ride to end the day on. So that was why Toy Story sort of seemed like the better choice for me. But I just sort of love it. I just find it so funny. But I love the aspects of it where it sort of played with sort of product placement in a way that where you had these real toys in the mix. So you had that dimension to it along with the sort of fictionalized toys, and just really believing that Buzz Lightyear would just be this toy that everyone would want, and Pizza Planet just seeming like the most exciting place you could possibly go for a birthday party. Like, I still sort of have regrets that that's not a real place you can actually go. I think they might have them at Disneyland, maybe sort of a version of it, but I've never been, so I'm not sure. It's just such a great film to sort of end on. And I also think, talking of the ending of the film, the final sort of set piece where they're trying to catch up with the moving truck, I just think it's just one of the great like action set pieces. It's just,
yeah,
again, it a bit like Jurassic Park as well, where just the set pieces just don't get old. And I always get like hairs on the back of my neck when they're kind of chasing, and then when they light the rocket, and then the whole falling with style business. Mm. I just love all that. And just again, I must have seen a lot. I wouldn't like to put a figure on it, but I must have seen it a lot over the years. And still, even now, it still kind of, you know, gets me. And it's never kind of got old to me. So, you know, obviously Pixar and others have improved on the animation in the years to come, like the kind of the dog looks a little bit ropey now, as does the baby and some of the humans, but it just doesn't matter, because it's just a sort of bulletproof film in that way, that because, you know, the script is so good, the story is so good, Woody and Buzz are just such kind of classic characters and a classic double act, that, you know, it just doesn't matter that the CGI is on the sort of creakier side now.
Have you met any of the voice actors? Have you met Woody?
Tom Hanks I did for Sully, which was exciting. And again, in real life, he just has that true sort of foghorn voice that you just associate with Tom Hanks, that feels like it could blast your face off almost. That was obviously a hugely exciting experience. I went to Pixar. That was another, obviously not a set visit, but that was another true career highlight for The Incredibles 2. I went there. Just being on the campus and just going past the massive lamp and ball. It was just, I was a proper kid in a candy store then. So also very, very high up there with the best sort of experiences I've had through the job.
you know, we always have like the one that got away, the one you really want to interview. Who is on your list for people you really would love to talk to?
I'd have to say probably the number one, which probably be most people's number ones, would be Steven Spielberg in terms of the people I haven't interviewed yet, just because obviously not many people have just done that many classics. And then and Scorsese I'd put on that level as well, in terms of obviously just these classics. Just someone you just know is just an absolutely fascinating chat as well. And equally, there could have equally been a couple of Scorsese films on this list as well. I'll always live in hope that I'll get to, like, you know, speak to Christopher Nolan again, and Richard Linklater I've been lucky to speak to a couple of times. So yeah, you just hope to get sort of further chances, really.
That's your final film for this evening of, well, it's going to be a whole day. It's a festival, yes, of Matt films. We now need to talk about your snacks. Are you a salty or sweet popcorner, or something completely different?
Well, salty and sweet when it comes to popcorn. I do love the mix, but I'm actually not the biggest popcorn fan. And like, I love the smell of it in the foyer, you know, and obviously it feels like a cinema snack, but I just prefer something like Minstrels, really.
Minstrels.
Or Reese's Pieces. I prefer like a chocolatey snack than popcorn.
But they're not very nice when they go a bit sort of moist in the bottom of the bag.
No, but they never really last very long for me, because I always pretty much I have to eat them before the trailers are finished.
Oh,
because
wow.
It's too sort of interrupting of the film, really, I think, to be sort of eating sweets throughout.
So you're not an advocate of people having like a full meal at the cinema?
No, I can't get into that. The best thing is obviously having dinner after the film, because
yeah,
then
talk about it.
And that's one of, like, you need to build that into the whole experience, really. So yeah, so just a little like sweet snack to keep you going through the film is what you should be eating in there.
And are you a fan of trailers? Do you get there for the trailers, or are you someone who tries to get in just as they've finished whilst you're being told to turn off your phone?
No, I love the trailers. Yeah, I always try and get there for the trailers, the sort of the adverts, the weird little adverts for local dentists and stuff you get beforehand. Just that, to me, really adds to the sort of ceremony of going out, and again, prepares you. And again, I feel like during trailers and adverts, it's fine to have a little chat. Obviously, as I just said, that's my snack time. That it's the time to sort of wind down. And it's a thing I found odd about press screenings, actually, when I first started doing this job, that because you rarely get trailers in press screenings, I found it a bit discombobulating being thrown in and the lights just going down and the film just starting. So I've got used to it now, obviously, but I do like that bit of, you know, time.
The decompression.
Time to, you know, get fully into the cinema experience. And obviously trailers can give away too much these days. We often grumble in the office that, you know, too much is sport in trailers, and which is completely true. But I do just love trailers as well. I mean, I love getting excited for what else is coming up. So I'll always want to watch them, basically. And I like seeing how they play with the crowd as well, because we obviously have our little trailer clubs in the office where we'll all gather around someone's desk and watch the latest trailer that's just dropped. But I like seeing how it just plays to
an audience,
a crowd of punters as well. So I like that side of it as well. See what gets the laughs and things like that.
And as the screen burns at the end of this day, what soundtrack from a movie are you playing?
This is a really difficult one for me, because as you will know, and long-time Total Film readers may know, controversially, I'm not the biggest fan of listening to soundtracks out of context of the film, because more than anything, it's that thing that I don't want to rob them of their sort of power when I do watch the film by becoming just too familiar with them as a soundtrack. But I don't have a completely hard and fast rule on that, and there's certain soundtracks I do really like. But for this, I had to stick with the Pixar theme, segueing straight from Toy Story being the last film, and go for Married Life from Up by Michael Giacchino, just because I just absolutely love that score, and had it playing sort of in the build-up to our wedding. So it's got sort of special memories. It's obviously very moving, but also quite sort of jaunty and jolly at the same time. It runs the whole gamut of emotion. So that would be my sort of send-off tune, I think.
And who will you be taking to the cinema? Who are your favourite people to watch a film with in the dark?
Well, obviously my Total Film colleagues.
Yeah.
And as I was saying earlier, my wife, obviously, because she always gives me that kind of normal person perspective, perhaps when, you know, our heads have been too much into the film. Obviously, family, friends, but I would just like it to be full. I just think you just can't beat that sort of full auditorium feeling. So basically, you know, I'm happy to have anyone along to fill up the numbers.
As long as they don't use their phone, obviously.
No, I mean, there'd be very, very strict rules on phone use, talking throughout. I mean, I'd even be very strict on toilet breaks, to be honest. I think
go
before you go in. You know, there's an intermission in 2001, so you're sort of covered there. I'll allow plenty of time between films so people can kind of
stretch
themselves
legs.
Out.
Yeah.
Anyone who's well behaved is welcome.
Perfect. Okay, so Matt's last picture show programme will be 2001, A Space Odyssey, The Dark Knight, Before Sunset, and Toy Story. Let us know over Twitter if you'd be up for sitting in the dark for that lineup. But for now, thanks for sharing your programme, Matt. And we'll be back with another last picture show. So come back to see who else is in the projector booth next time.
That was the Last Picture Show podcast from Total Film. Let us know what four films you'd watch at the end of the world. You can tweet us on @TotalFilm or connect with us on Facebook or our Instagram page.